This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Well, summertime is just around the corner. Maybe time to get away, and I mean really get away. This week, NASA announced its new class of astronauts who will be training for eventual spaceflight and a chance to really get away from it all. Joining me now to talk about their selections and other short subjects in science is Sophie Bushwick, senior editor at Popular Science. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
First, congratulations to your team, Popular Sci, for winners of this year's Sci-Fi Trivia Contest.
We were very excited to win.
It was a lot of fun, wasn't it?
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about these lucky dozen people who were chosen.
Right, so NASA announced their new class, and they had a record number of applicants. Out of more than 18,000 applicants, only 12 are new astronauts. That means they had a 0.05% chance of making it, and their list of accomplishments is really staggering. So the new class includes 5 women and 7 men, and some of them are decorated members of the military. Others have been doing research. Some are doctors. Some have a combination of all three. It's just, if you ever start feeling pretty good about what you've done with your life, just don't read what these astronauts have been up to, because you'll just feel bad.
Oh, yeah, they all have the right stuff. So what happens next? What kind of training do they go through? How many years?
They're going to go through a couple years of training. They get to, you know, go into the pool where they get to practice being in weightless. They get to train in flying different types of spacecraft. They get to practice learning about the systems that they would be using on the International Space Station. And I mean, it's possible that the people who are in this class could, if NASA meets its highest goals, they could be going to Mars, even if that's in the books coming up.
Mars, yeah. I think people would sign up for that.
Yeah.
Because they had a record number of applications, didn't they?
Yeah, they had 18,000 applicants. Before this, the greatest number of applicants they had was 8,000. So they just smashed that record.
Wow. All right, let's move on to another story. There's a study out this week about bread.
That's right.
Not money, but the kind you eat.
Bread. Yeah, the delicious kind. I mean, because we're used to thinking about, you know, white bread is unhealthy and wheat bread is healthy. So researchers fed a group, it was a small group, just a starter study, really, of 20 people. They fed them either whole wheat sourdough bread or white bread for a period of weeks, and then they let their bodies recover and reversed it so they could see how the same people responded to the diet. And then they looked at how their blood sugar spiked in response, and they found that even though you might expect that your blood sugar would spike more in response to white bread, that was only true for about half the participants. Some of the participants actually had a higher blood sugar spike in response to the wheat bread, which is a kind of counterintuitive result.
Mm-hmm. But we don't know anything about how it affects your microbiome.
Well, they think that the microbiome might be causing that difference, that some people might have stomach microbes that respond better to white bread and others that respond better to wheat bread.
This is a very small study, though.
Right. This was about 20 people.
Over 2 weeks.
Over 2 weeks on one bread and then 2 weeks on another bread. So I think it's an intriguing result, but it's one that I'd hope that we'd see a follow-up study with a larger group of participants.
Yeah, because, you know, usually there are thousands of people on 6 months to a year or more.
Right. In comparison, this is tiny. But I think that something and another thing to bear in mind is not only is it tiny, but they were looking at one aspect of health, at how your blood sugar responds to bread. But in the larger picture, wheat bread it's not just how it affects your blood sugar, it's that it has more fiber and it has more vitamins. And don't go out and buy up all the Wonder Bread and just say you're on a diet, you know, not yet.
I'm still sticking with the whole grains. you have a story about equality between dogs and wolves. They have this thing about equality.
Dogs and wolves care about fairness. So this is actually a really cool study from the Wolf Center in Vienna. They had both dogs and wolves. You'd put two of the animals together. They'd be partners. And they were trained to push a button and get a treat in response. So the options for treats were they'd get no treat and the partner got a treat, or they would get one quality treat and the partner would get a nicer treat. So maybe the subject dog gets kibble, but its partner gets meat. And in response, they stopped playing the game. They were like,
the
dog stopped playing the game. And they said, you know what, if I'm not getting the same as my partner, we're not gonna participate. And actually the same thing happened with wolves, which is really interesting, because this means dogs didn't get their sense of fairness from us. They could have inherited it from their wolf ancestors, but it's not that we trained them to care about what's fair and what's not.
You know, I remember a story a few years ago about chimpanzees. It was sort of the same thing.
Caring about.
Do you remember that?
Fair treatment.
They had some chimps, and they gave the one chimp they gave a little bit of something, and the other one they gave it a beautiful grape. You know, maybe it was a cucumber versus a grape. Mm-hmm. And the chimp started saying, hey, I'm not doing anything until I get that grape. You know?
Right. Yeah, this is the same, definitely the same idea, that you treat us fairly or we're not going to play ball.
That's right. Well, at least it's consistency. And there's something that it could affect our weekend plans, sleep. You have talking about sleep.
Right. We love talking about, like, oh, I'm going to catch up on sleep this weekend. I'm going to sleep in. A recent study actually looked at that and said, well, for every extra hour you sleep in on the weekend, it increases your odds of heart disease by about 11%. And the problem with this result is that that's a correlation, but it doesn't necessarily mean that sleeping in is causing the heart disease. It could be that if you're the kind of person who's staying up really late on a weekend, maybe you're drinking or smoking or, you know, having a bunch of junk food, then you're also probably going to have health problems as a result of that, and you're also probably going to be the kind of person who sleeps in later the next day.
Mm-hmm. Was this another one of these large studies or a tiny little study?
This was a large study, and I think that one of the things it does show is something that we've already known, that when you sleep in on the weekends, you kind of mess up your circadian rhythms. So if you get up at the same time every day, during weekdays and on weekends, then you're going to have your body clock will get you ready to wake up around that same time. Whereas if you break the pattern by sleeping in on weekends and getting up early on weekdays, then when Monday rolls around, you're going to be really tired because your body's not ready to wake you up.
Yeah, they say keep your pattern during the week. And also, you know, at the same time.
Yeah, that's the goal. That's the best way for you to make sure you get a good night's
sleep. Sure, that's what everybody does.
Of course.
All right, Sophie, thanks for taking time to be with us today. So, Sophie Bushwick, senior editor at Popular Science. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. The scientists behind the 30-meter telescope have some lofty goals. See some of the oldest objects in the universe, take a closer look at exoplanets, maybe even help us find evidence of life. But it has been complicated getting the telescope built. They lost their building permit at Hawaii's Mauna Kea mountaintop in 2015 after a native Hawaiian sued. Mauna Kea, it turns out, is one of the most sacred spots in the Hawaiian archipelago. The good news, the 30-meter telescope team has a backup site on the Canary Islands in Spain. But as you'll soon hear, switching sites, well, it would not come without costs. Michael Wall, senior writer for Space.com, is with us. He's based in San Francisco. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's good to hear that there's another site for the telescope. Now we can be sure the telescope will be built?
Yeah. I mean, it certainly looks that way. They would still like to build it in, like, Hawaii, if at all possible. That's the main site, but now they do have a backup site, so they, like, do have a path forward if Hawaii doesn't work out.
So that's the good news, then.
Yes. But there is bad news, and that's that the Canary Islands site, which is the backup site they've decided on, is considerably lower in elevation. It's about 6,000 feet lower, actually, which means that if you build the telescope there, it has to peer up through a lot more atmosphere, and that makes it a lot harder to actually see into space.
Oh, that is not a good thing. It's not a good thing, because you want to go to as high as possible without the atmosphere.
Right. And they could take mitigating moves to actually kind of get over that, but they would require putting some more adaptive optics on the Canary Islands scope, which basically means they would have to add a little bit more gear to kind of correct for the sort of blurring effects of that much more atmosphere. And it's still possible that won't still be able to totally counteract the atmospheric effects. So, there's a reason why the Hawaii site was a scientifically preferred site in the first place. And so they would still hope to build it there.
Well, aren't there any other sites out there that could be just as good as Mauna Kea? Maybe in Chile, isn't there a telescope already in Chile? Maybe piggyback on that?
Yeah, there are a lot of telescopes being built down there. You know, that's a great site. It's really high up and it's got really, really dry air. But they actually want to build this one in the Northern Hemisphere because there are already two giant telescopes that are going to be sort of similar. that are already going up in down in the Chilean Andes. So what they'd really like is to have one in the northern hemisphere, which will be able to see different parts of the sky and, like, therefore different objects, and also kind of, like, link up with a bunch of the northern hemisphere telescopes so that they can perform similar studies on similar parts of the sky. They don't want to put all of the giant megascopes on Earth, like the same little patch of southern hemisphere, to look at the same part of the sky. So yeah, that's kind of part of the reason why they chose Hawaii in the first place, was to give us better coverage for these giant scopes.
Why not just upgrade Mount Palomar out there in California?
You know? Yeah, well, that's got pros and cons too. We could talk about that, but you know, it's close to some bigger cities. It's not quite so high up. You got some California smog coming into play there too.
Yeah, well, it's a wonderful telescope. It has been an icon for decades. But let's get back to the ending of this. How much longer will it take to know whether the 30-meter telescope and where will end up?
Well, that's sort of the thing, is it's still up in the air, sort of. I mean, like, we're expecting to hear, like, a new ruling about whether construction can actually go forward in the next, I don't know, a couple months or so. But like, nobody really knows, and, like, nobody knows if there will be a challenge after that. Like, after that judgment is handed down. So, yeah, we're still waiting. They would ideally like to start construction by spring of 2018. So, I mean, something's probably going to happen within the next, I don't know, 7-8 months where we get something wrapped up and there's a final decision made. But, yeah, we don't really know, like, when that's going to happen exactly or what that decision's going to be. So we just have to wait and see.
All right, we'll have you back when they make that decision, Michael. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Sure, thank you.
Michael Wall, senior writer for Space.com, based in San Francisco. When we come back, we're going to take a break and talk about summer science. We've got the latest in sunscreen news, and it's not so good. 73% of the sunscreen stuff you buy out there, it doesn't work, at least according to a study. We'll talk about what to do about that. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Sunscreen use is on the rise. That's the good news. The bad news, so are cases of skin cancer. What's that all about? Well, it could be the type of sunscreen you're using. A poor quality sunscreen might keep you from getting a sunburn, but it won't shield skin from harmful ultraviolet rays that cause melanoma. And recently, scientists with the Environmental Working Group tested almost 1,500 sunscreens, moisturizers, and lip balm that advertise sun protection. And they found that 73% of those products don't provide the protection consumers think they're getting. And one of those scientists is my next guest, David Andrews, senior scientist at the Environmental Working Group. Welcome to Science Friday.
Pleasure to speak with you today, Ira.
How can 73% of those products fail?
Right, and so this is 73% of those products, huge percent. These are products that don't meet our standards in terms of product efficacy, how good a job that they're doing at protecting us from both sunburn as well as those UVAs you were discussing, or contain concerning ingredients. So we did flag out products that we thought were contained ingredients that may be a health concern.
Hmm. So what exactly makes a poor quality sunscreen?
Well, most sunscreens, there's a direct response to know whether or not it works. You apply the sunscreen, you spend some time in the sun, and if you didn't have enough sunscreen or a high enough SPF, you'll know a few hours later or the next morning your skin turns red. You've got a direct feedback whether or not you're getting enough SPF protection or sun protection factor. Mm-hmm. But whether or not that product is providing adequate UVA protection, and that's really critical for reducing long-term skin damage. It may lead to wrinkles or play an important role in melanoma development. You don't really get that feedback for potentially decades. And so that's why it's critical for sunscreens to provide both the sunburn protection as well as comprehensive UVA protection, really as much as possible.
Let's talk about UVA that you're mentioning and UVB. There are two kinds of ultraviolet, correct? Give us the reasons that you need both of them.
Right. These are two kinds of ultraviolet light, ultraviolet radiation that are emitted from the sun. The UVB radiation that I was speaking about, this is higher energy light and can react more directly with the skin. It can cause direct DNA damage, and actually UVB UVB light is predominantly responsible for sunburns. The UVA is a longer wavelength. This is ultraviolet light that's actually closer to the visible spectrum. This is where you're getting into the blue light. It also plays an important role in causing health impacts, and those are the longer-term health impacts, especially melanoma development, and playing an important role in that, as well as long-term skin cancer or long-term skin damage like wrinkles and skin aging.
Do some products available here, do they contain the product that blocks UVA, or do you have to? I remember being in London shopping in the Boots, you know, their drugstore over there, and I could get suntan screen that had both protection in it. But when I came back to the States, it didn't say that on the labels over here.
In the last 5 years, we've actually seen a shift, and a high percentage of products include at least some filtration for UVA. And that's due to a change made by the Food and Drug Administration in 2011. But we don't think products are providing adequate amounts of UVA protection, especially in relationship to the SPF on the label. And so we think it's imperative that those values be very balanced. For an example, a T-shirt will give you perfect balance across the entire spectrum. It'll do just as well of blocking the UVA light as it does of the UVB radiation.
Is there an ingredient we should be looking for on the label?
In the U.S.,
the
two ingredients that stand out that provide the best UVA protection are zinc oxide, and that's an ingredient that's found in the majority of our top products. The other ingredient would be avobenzone, and it's found at a concentration up to 3%. And we recommend seeking out products that would have 3% of that ingredient and an SPF between 30 and 50 typically.
Mm-hmm. So you should look into that. I mentioned the European sunscreens. Why are they not available if they work better in America?
That's a great question. And really, the FDA has kind of backed themselves into a corner here in many ways. How people use sunscreen has changed significantly in the past 30 years. Originally, people were using these products occasionally, beach holidays, to reduce sunburns. Now people are using sunscreens much more commonly, daily often, covering large portions of their body. And so FDA has changed the amount of safety information they're looking for before allowing new ingredients on the market. At the same time, they can't go back and request additional safety data for the ingredients that are already in products. So there's a sliding scale of how much safety information the agency is looking for. But these new ingredients being used in Europe, Canada, and other places in the world look to offer much better UVA protection. So we're really in a tough spot, especially with the backdrop of melanoma rates, which have been rising at close to 2% a year for decades.
And is it because we're using them incorrectly, the ones that are available to us? I mean, are we putting them on on the label, every 20 minutes after you go in the water? If you used it more like the label recommends, would you get better protection?
You'll definitely get better protection if you use it more often, you apply liberally, you reapply every 2 hours. One thing that we're very concerned about is something called the compensation hypothesis. And what this hypothesis is that when people apply sunscreen, they change their behavior and actually spend more time in the sun. If you do that, you're largely negating the benefits of the sunscreen. And so it's imperative that you're using sunscreen not to prolong your time in the sun, but as part of a sun protection strategy that includes hats, shirts, and seeking shade. You can't just rely on sunscreen use alone to reduce the UV radiation and reduce the long-term skin damage and potentially cancer.
See, you have a false sense then of safety when you put it on.
Oftentimes, that's what we're very concerned about, that people get a false sense of security, and then that false sense of security increases, actually, when you use these higher SPF products. There's products out there with SPF 100. It almost makes you feel like you're invincible to the sun's rays when you're wearing this product, and may lead to what is ultimately damaging sun behavior.
Mm-hmm. So does the SPF number above 50 mean anything? You know, I mean, is it...
This is a question that the Food and Drug Administration raised, that concerns that SPF values above 50 had little value, had little meaning for consumers. And actually, I think as an example of this issue, Procter & Gamble, just over 5 years ago, submitted an SPF 100 product that they bought off the shelves to four different testing labs around the country. And the results they got back varied from an SPF 74 all the way down to an SPF 37. And so there's none of them reproduced the SPF 100 on the label. But an important point here is that the difference in UV radiation that went through that product, the difference between an SPF 37 and an SPF 100, is just over 1.5%. So it's an extremely small difference in UV radiation hitting the skin, but it leads to this enormous difference in SPF number on the product. And so ultimately, there's not very much difference between an SPF 35 and an SPF 100.
So you're saying that just wear a T-shirt, you'll get good protection.
I think that's a great idea. Wear a T-shirt. And in certain circumstances, you'll definitely want to wear sunscreen. We think it's an important part of reducing UV rays, of sun safety. But be cognizant of not using a sunscreen to prolong the time you spend outside.
There you go. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure.
David Andrews, a senior scientist at the Environmental Working Group. There is no perfect way to protect your skin from sun damage, and whether you have to lather up constantly or never get a sunburn depends on the pigment, the melanin that makes up your skin. Now, melanin produced by your body isn't something you can change at will, but a group of researchers has discovered a way to create a melanin-like substance in the lab that can be tuned to different shades, darker or lighter, which corresponds with UV protection. So could we soon see products containing melanin-like material replacing the traditional sunscreens on the market today? Here with me to discuss this new research is my guest, Ryan Uhlein, professor of chemistry and director of the Nanoscience Initiative at the Advanced Science Research Center at City University here in New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
So what's the connection between melanin and its UV properties on your body?
So melanin is an incredibly interesting material. It serves many functions across all living species. It provides UV protection. It provides free radical scavenging, and it can also have other properties like mechanical properties. And so it's a protective layer found in many species. The way it's produced in a biological context is it's essentially made in small organelles known as melanosomes, and there's a polymerization reaction that takes place inside these melanosomes, and that makes the melanin-like material. And as you're exposed to UV more, the body responds to that and produces more of that material.
So is your research saying that basically you have made synthetic melanin?
It's not strictly synthetic melanin, I would say, because it has some chemical signatures that are slightly different. So the purist would say it's not synthetic melanin. However, it's potentially even more exciting because it is highly tunable, and we can control the properties of this synthetic melanin mimic.
It changes color and when you put it in UV. It's in a petri dish and you shine light on it and it turns darker.
Not dynamically like that. Let me try to explain how it works. So the way biology does this is, as I said, by a polymerization reaction that starts with tyrosine, a common amino acid found everywhere in the body. So tyrosine is polymerized, is first oxidized to a highly reactive oxidizing species, and these polymerize. So these form long, complex chains of molecules. And you end up with a polymer, a network-type polymer that then has the unique melanin properties. The difficulty is, though, that the cool thing about biology is that this is all very tightly regulated. So it is a polymerization that's guided, and it's guided by assembly of these precursors. So they're not just freely available to react, where they can. they are presented appropriately so that a tunable melanin and a reproducible melanin is formed. And that's been very difficult to reproduce in the lab. So if you take tyrosine and you oxidize it in the lab, you can make black insoluble polymers, but they are not very useful because they don't have tunable and precise properties.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. In case you joined us, we're talking with Ryan Uline of CUNY here. So you got, but now you're able to tune it to different colors. And what practical use now can we make? You make a cream out of this or what?
Yeah, so let me first quickly explain how we tune it, because
we only have a few minutes left.
Sure, so. Right. So the tunability relates to how we pre-organize the tyrosine molecules, and that gives us a different color. So yes, you now have a material that is has properties that are dependent on the ingredients that you put in the first place. So you could process this in water. To ultimately have an ingredient that you could add to cosmetic creams, and I'm not a cosmetics expert, but we've talked to a couple of cosmetics companies, and they believe that these things have real applications as ingredients for cosmetic products.
And how much of the ultraviolet could you actually block out?
So what we have so far is we've demonstrated that we can cover the UVA and the UVB range. Depending on, again, the ingredients, so that's the tunability, we can access UVA more or UVB more. We can have a level of SPF. How it compares with existing materials is hard to tell at the moment.
So I'm envisioning sort of a switch or something. I can change the color of my melanin that I'm putting on, the synthetic stuff that you're making.
Yeah, it's not an in situ switch. Yeah. It is a predetermined switch. So you would have to, in advance, decide what kind of pigmentation you're looking for, and in that sense, it is tunable.
So could you go like into a tanning center like we have now instead of getting exposed to UVA or whatever? You could be sprayed with all over your body with what you have, or are you thinking it's more topical where you're going
to have it? It's more topical, actually. Yeah. It's nothing to do with the tanning station. It would be really like think about a cosmetic product that has SPF built in.
Right.
Those are very, very common. So this could be an ingredient that replaces the existing SPF.
And FDA approval yet?
No, we are. It's early days. We've been doing this for the past year, but we are hopeful because all the ingredients that we use to make these materials are themselves derived from amino acids, and they have a good status at FDA. They have so-called GRAS status.
Yeah, I know what that is. Yeah. What else? What's the one thing that's missing now? Well, where's the next step?
Well, there's a lot more that needs to be done. I mean, despite the fact that we can now control the formation of these materials much better than what was possible previously, there are still many questions about exactly how the chemical connection works and how exactly the function relates to the molecular properties. So this is something that can keep us going for quite some time. There are also more exotic applications. We're working with a collaborator at Carnegie Mellon University, Christopher Bettinger, who's looking at battery-like applications of these materials. So there's no shortage of exciting things that can be done now that we can tune the formation of these materials.
Battery, charging battery with solar? Maybe.
Not solar charged. It would be an ion storage capacity, so releasing ions on demand and use that as an electric storage.
Wow. So you could start out with melanin for the skin and wind up with a breakthrough in battery storage technology.
I don't know.
You don't know what path you might take on it.
Yes, well, that will be probably a decade down the line, but certainly as scientists, it keeps us excited and keeps us going.
We like it when you get excited. Thank you, Ryan Uline, Professor of Chemistry, Director of the Nanoscience Initiative at CUNY's Advanced Science Research Center. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about this amazing finding that was released this week about Homo sapien fossils dating way back to 300,000 years ago and found in northern Africa, not southern Africa, where we find all the other fossils. It's, once again, checking up the human family tree. We'll talk about it after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This week, scientists published details of a fossil find that may shake up our understanding of where and when humanity arose. The fossils are said to be of Homo sapiens from around 300,000 years ago, the oldest yet found, but they were found at a site in present-day Morocco, northern Africa, not the more southern sites in Ethiopia's Rift Valley that many had taken to be calling the cradle of humanity. Not everyone is on board with this interpretation of the fossils, which was published this week in the journal Nature. But at the very least, it raises new questions about what it means to be a member of the species Homo sapiens. Joining me now to talk about the find and other paleoanthropological news is Shira Bailey. She's an associate professor in the Department of Anthropology at New York University and is one of the authors of the new paper. And she is a specialist in teeth. Right?
Dr.
Bailey, she's here with us. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Let's talk about what was found in this Moroccan site. Skulls, teeth, long bones, an incredible find.
Yeah, all sorts of things. And the great thing about it was that in this recent excavation from 2004 on, we were able to supplement earlier finds from the 1960s. And because these new fossils were found in situ and we were able to know exactly where they were, that allowed us to do a much better job of dating them.
And going back that far, 300,000 years, that's at least 100,000 years earlier.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it?
So what does that mean about where we think that, you know, the cradle of humanity was in Africa? Does it upset the thinking about Ethiopia?
Well, I think what it means is when we think about a cradle of humanity, we have to think about it in terms of the entirety of Africa. So rather than being one specific place that modern human morphology originated in, and in fact, bits and pieces may have evolved in different places and then, of course, merged together as people merged together.
Because we've had Homo naledi now found where it shouldn't be.
Yes.
Right? We have those what we call the hobbits that are offshore.
Yeah, yeah.
And doesn't it seem to be that these Ethiopia is an outlier.
yeah. Well, it's funny you bring up naledi because, you know, the dates on those are somewhere around the same time period. So what that means is you've got two different species clearly living at the same time. Probably we'll find them modern humans. I imagine we'll find modern humans this old in other places in Africa as well.
And now, of course, you're going to get, when you make such a claim about these fossils, you're going to get some pushback from people saying, you know, extraordinary claims, extraordinary evidence.
I think we have extraordinary evidence, actually.
Tell me why you mean that.
Well, you know, we did a very careful study of all aspects of the morphology of the skeletal material that is preserved. So the cranium and the dentition and long bones, et cetera. And everything points to them being, if they're derived, they're derived in a modern human way. There are some aspects of the skull of the endocranium that are kind of primitive. They have rather large brow ridges, and the forehead is a little bit slopey. But there are aspects of the dentition, which, of course, is my specialty, as you mentioned, that are only found in modern humans. Only found in modern humans. So,
like what? What aspect?
Well, it's hard to describe these things.
You can get technical. You know, okay. We like to get into the weeds.
So, on your lower molars, right? So these are your chewing teeth. Mm-hmm. There are all sorts of crests and cusps and things. And there's a particular crest that we see in Neanderthals called a middle trigonid crest. So it's a crest that connects the forwardmost cusps of your lower molar. And if you on the enamel surface, you can find this. It's in a really high frequency in Neanderthals. You can find it in, 15% of modern humans and maybe some Homo erectus. But when you take the enamel off and look at the dentine underneath, which is what we were able to do because these fossils were micro-CT scanned, that crest is only missing in Homo sapiens. Okay, so even in individuals, Homo erectus, who don't appear to have a crest on the enamel surface, when you take the enamel off, the dentine preserves that crest. So far, the only species I've seen that are completely missing that crest are Homo sapiens. And then there's other aspects of the molar shape. The cool thing about this study is we weren't just saying it's not Neanderthal, therefore it must be Homo sapiens. We compared these fossils to other archaic Homo sapiens. We compare them to Homo erectus. And if in every way, these fossils either fall completely within recent or early Homo sapiens variation or in between something and Homo sapiens, like Homo erectus and Homo sapiens. So they never fall with erectines, which means it's not primitive morphology. It's changed since the ancestral pattern.
You seem very energized.
It's so exciting. You probably don't see many people so excited about teeth.
My dentist, but he's getting paid to be excited about teeth.
I love it. You know, I was really, honestly, when, you know, we've been working on this material for a long time. I knew there's a kind of a gestalt feeling you get when you look at teeth long enough. And I looked at them even before we did analyses. I was like, they look modern to me. What excites me is the age. And, you know, when they told me it was 300,000 years, I was like, what, are you sure? What, you know, and are you really sure? And it's very secure. And so for me, this is really exciting to push this back another 100,000 years.
Because they also found some hunting tools and things like remnants of hunting, but to you, it's the teeth.
Yes.
That tell the story.
It is. The teeth tell the story.
So would you say then that we're on the cusp of another idea about, you know?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, it also shows us that some aspects of the human body evolve earlier than others. So it looks like, and so good for me, the teeth seem to be giving us the signal earlier than, let's say, the skull. Even though the face is very modern, there are aspects of the skull that are kind of primitive.
That's fascinating. So you would assume then if we found these other fossils around Africa, there should be other places we would find equally old and fascinating fossils.
The genetic evidence suggests that Neanderthals and modern humans split somewhere between 500 and 700,000 years ago. Now, we know that we have Neanderthal ancestors in Spain at the site called Cima de los Huesos at least 400,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. So why wouldn't we have the beginnings of the modern human lineage going back even that far? So I think it's possible that as we keep looking in Africa, I mean, it's a big place, we might find additional fossils that are as old, if not older.
Let me see if our listeners want to get in on this. Our number, 844-724-8255. You can also call us, if you like to use the SciTalk number, 844-SciTalk. You can also tweet us at SciFry. You're also involved with some other prominent fossil finds. I mentioned before the Hobbit and the Homo naledi.
Mm-hmm.
Do they match the teeth, the kind of teeth you found with this fossil? Are they different kinds of teeth on those fossils?
Oh, no, they're completely different.
Totally different.
Completely different, yeah. Homo naledi is a very odd, the dentition is very, very odd. It has a very strange combination of primitive characteristics, Homo characteristics, and derived towards some robust osteopathy. It's a very strange mosaic chimera, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And Homo floresiensis, if you look at everything on the dentition except for the lower first bicuspid, it looks like a modern human dentally. That lower first bicuspid is something I've never seen anywhere in the fossil record or the recent human material I've seen.
Mm-hmm. You are the subject of our latest macroscope, our video.
Yes, it just came out yesterday, I think.
Yeah, a video on sciencefriday.com. We came into your lab and we shared your fascination with all these teeth that you look at. And when did you first start to get interested in teeth? And people look at you weird when you say, I want to study teeth.
They do, yeah. They do.
In a good way, I hope.
The first thing I look at people, unfortunately, are their teeth. So
I'm closing my mouth now.
You know, I was inspired by an article I read by Christy Turner from Arizona State University on how dental morphology, and those are the bumps and grooves and stuff we study on teeth, linked Native Americans to Northeast Asians. And at the time, I was very interested in Native American origins and the Southwest. And so a year after that, I packed up and I moved to Arizona State University, or to Tempe, and studied with Christy Turner. And it was kind of just, it went off from there. He was a very inspirational teacher and mentor.
And I noticed you give us a lesson on the video on the cusps.
Yes.
On the teeth. I didn't realize how each one of our molars has a different number of those little bumps. They're called cusps.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. So most people on their first molar have five cusps. if you have four, you're more likely to be European or of some kind of some population that has a long history of farming, because having four cusps is related to having smaller teeth. Having smaller teeth is related to having a long history of farming, for various reasons that have to do with your jaws getting smaller.
Let's go to the phones with a call. Let's go to California to, is it Rena in California?
Rena,
welcome.
Thank you. Hi, I had a question about how one gets into the science of teeth. I'm currently a biology major, and I'm interested in pursuing a PhD program, and I'm wondering how you go into that sort of thing.
You apply to graduate programs and you write a really good personal statement, and you connect with professors you might be interested in working with. I highly recommend doing that, because when we have a name to put with a, or a face to put with a name, or something more than just your name on paper, it's it makes us more likely to consider you for a program.
Good luck to you, Raina. I guess she's gone. How do you go about being so sure of the dating of this last find?
Well, as I said, the new fossils were discovered in 2004, and they're in situ, which means we know exactly where they were found. And so what they do with this kind of dating is, the dating is one of the types of dating they use is based on trapped electrons. And so what you do is you put a dosimeter into the matrix in which the fossils were found, and you leave it there for a while. And then you measure the accumulation rate. And so in this way, we know exactly what the accumulation rate is of electrons in that particular part of the site. With the materials that were found in 1960, they kind of knew where they were found, you know, and they did the same kind of, things with the dosimeters. But this is much more accurate because we know exactly where they were found. And that's why the date got pushed back a little more.
Can we tell what they were eating?
Well, the faunal remains suggest they were eating large ungulates and large mammals.
Really?
Yeah.
So they were hunting?
Yeah.
Killing?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I can't really tell from the teeth. We haven't done any studies of the tartar, which, you know, that stuff the dentist scrapes off your teeth. If we could look at what their diet was based on that, because both DNA and plant remains are contained in your tartar.
Wow. Wow. Wow.
Who knew, right?
Who knows what's in my tartar? This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. In case you're just joining us, we're talking with Shara Bailey, Associate Professor of Anthropology at NYU and co-author of a paper in Nature this week. And she's also the subject of a new macroscope video on our website. If you want to know about teeth and her work, it's an education, sciencefriday.com/teeth. It's also beautifully shot. How many teeth do you have in your lab, do you think?
Hundreds.
How many teeth do you think you've looked at?
Thousands.
Tens of thousands?
Maybe not tens of thousands, but certainly thousands, because I've looked at teeth from most geographic populations that represent the world. And then I've looked at, I would say, almost every fossil tooth that's available for study, and that's the topic of a book I'm working on, hopefully.
A new book.
Yeah, it's called The Evolution of the Human Dentition. I'll probably sell about 200 of them, too, like the only people in the world who are...
Change the name a little bit, make it a little sexier. I know about
I'll
the publishers, right? Got to get Dracula on the cover or something. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Ralph in Apple Valley, Minnesota. Hi, Ralph.
Hi. My question was, how much have humans changed since then? If you dressed these folks up in jeans and T-shirts, would they be indistinguishable from someone on the street?
Hmm. Someone in New York City? No. No. You would not pick them out of a crowd, especially if they had a hat on.
Because the
face below the eyes looks very looks like us. It's only the kind of slopey forehead that that looks a little primitive. But I'll tell you, I've seen some people with some big brow ridges around New York City, and so.
Yes, not going there. Let's go to Dan in New Jersey. Speaking of around New York, hi Dan.
Hi, I was wondering if the new find had any implications on the Bering Strait theory.
Well, I think you might be talking about Native Americans coming across the Bering Land Bridge into, I'm sorry, Northeast Asians coming across the Bering Land Bridge into North America and peopling the Americas. That probably happened. I know there's a recent claim for it for finds dating back older than 100,000 years ago. I'm not convinced by that myself. But that migration probably only happened about 15,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. So these new finds are much, much older.
Here's a tweet from Brent Saunders that says, understanding big swings in geotime, but what implications for how many hominid species living near or with each other at the same time? I mean, finding all these.
Yeah. No, it's incredible because, you know, we think of ourselves and we look at ourselves today and we can't imagine another human species living at the same time. But in fact, that was probably the norm rather than the exception. We are the exception now. It not just 300,000 years ago, but a couple million years ago, you had early Homo habilis living alongside robust Australopithecines and perhaps other hominins as well.
This is one of the most interesting finds you've worked on? Yeah. Favorite?
Yeah. The Homo naledi stuff, I have to say, is pretty cool, too, because it's so strange.
You have a cool job.
Thank you. I think so.
Yeah. Well, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Shira Bailey, Associate Professor in the Department of Anthropology at NYU. And the topic of our latest macroscope video on ScienceFriday.com. If you want to see why teeth make her so excited, you can check out our video. It's right there on our website, ScienceFriday.com/teeth. You can read to read the cusps on your own molars from that video. It's almost time for Cephalopod Week. Yeah, Science Friday is teaming up with Atlas Obscura for a series of cephalopod movie nights in New York, L.A., Chicago, and San Francisco. Join us for the movie nights out there, and you can find out more. Get tickets at ScienceFriday.com/movie night. We just love our Cephalopod Week. L.A., New York, Chicago, San Francisco. Charles Berquist is our director, senior producer Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, Katie Heiler, Rich Kim, our technical director, and Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz, our engineers at the controls here of the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.